www.mtc.group. We ask at this time that you silence your cell phones that may distract others during our meeting. We've got a good speaker tonight in a very closed room, so that'll be good. Very intimate. Please put your hands together and welcome our speaker tonight, Keith G. from Jewels of Recovery.
Hey, my name's Keith Gillette. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Keith.
It's good to be here. I have a sobriety date, January 1st of 1987. I just celebrated 39 years. I came into AA when I was 17, junior in high school, and I just turned 56 a couple weeks before I celebrate my anniversary. So I have a sponsor. I have a home group. Joys of Recovery is my home group. I'm pretty active. I'm there every week. I sponsor people. I don't run their lives, but I sponsor people. And, you know, the longer I have been sober in AA, the more I read your book and the more knowledge and more experience I gain with it. And I love that. I love it. Sometimes it's just time to learn something, you know, and something pops out of that big book. No one's ever hid it from me. It was just time to learn it. And it just shows itself up in the, when I'm reading it. So I love that. I never know what I'm going to say at these things. I don't plan it. I'm not a professional speaker by any stretch. I like talking. I like talking about alcoholism, and I don't like talking that much about getting drunk. I never have to, qualify in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't read anything in the literature that says I have to qualify. And believe me, I've read a lot. I've read a lot. There's some things I haven't read yet. I'm on my way to doing that now, but nothing says that I have to qualify. But what I think is important that I've learned is, these are for people who haven't gotten the message yet to identify that they're in the right place. And how do I know that I'm in the right place? I don't know that I'm in the right place because I hear the requirements of 30 DUIs and 15 wives later and toppling Fortune 500 companies and sailing the ocean blue, so to speak. All that sounds sexy. Believe me, when you're 17 years old getting sober in AA, you're like, man, I must have missed out, man. It sounds great. 30 DUIs and running from the police, hair on fire. Somebody screaming in flip-flops and a robe chasing you for alimony or back child support for, 20 years. I mean, that sounds wonderful. And if that was the requirement to be an alcoholic, I don't make the grade. I don't make the grade. If it takes being blacked out for 25 years nonstop every day, day in and day out, I don't meet the requirements. Not at all. If sitting out back behind 7-Eleven is the requirement, then I don't make it. I don't. I started drinking. I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and I was a 13-year-old kid that was as curious as anybody else is, and sitting around in the summertime off school all summer long. Our parents were poor, but they worked so hard we had no idea we were poor. And every year in the summertime, my family would go to a campground in Dearborn, and we would stay there for a month. And I loved it. I loved it. We'd swim and all that stuff all summer long. Ride our bikes. Everything was good, But when I was 13, all of a sudden, I'm no longer a child. I'm a teenager. I don't have anybody to hang out with, and all of a sudden these kids that were 17, 18, 19 years old, other kids in the park, they would tell us about going down to the lake and at nighttime and the bonfire, and we're like, man, that sounds great. And so I went out. I had curfew, just like anybody else did at 13. But they were all sitting around this campfire, and they were drinking on something that just looked amazing. It was green. The bottle was greenish. I don't know what it was. I would have wrote it down if I thought I was going to speak 39, 30, 40 some odd years later, but I didn't, sorry. I just knew that when they took a sip, they made this sound that made it sound so delicious. I mean, like, internally delicious. Like, it made me salivate. I'm like, I don't even know what that is, but I want it. I want it. You're making it sound so great right now. My experience with drinking was Mountain Dew, Pepsi, Tropicana, Minute Maid, milk, water, and that's all I had the experience of drinking at that time. And so when a bottle came around to me and I drank it, I put to my lips like it was a Mountain Dew. And it wasn't Mountain Dew. It hit my lips and got almost to the back of my throat before it just launched right out of my body. It felt like the rest of me came out of my body at the same time. I mean, from the toes all the way through, you know, just, and it was coming out of my nose and everybody was laughing. I was just like, oh, I missed it, you know? And everybody's, they start passing it around again and I'm like, it comes back. I'm gonna get it this time. That don't make no sense to anybody else that's not an alcoholic. Like, you put something to your lips that makes you retch like that, you'll never do it again. If that was a dog turd and it was on a plate and you said, take a bite, and I just retched it up, I'm not going in for a second. I'm just not. Don't make no sense, does it? And it did. It came right back to me and it got about halfway through down my throat. And the same thing. My eyes are burning. Snot's coming out of my nose. I just look pathetic and just, and they're all laughing. And third time came around and I started stretching. Getting it ready, going in for the big lift, and you know, I'm like, okay, hold your breath, push it down, make it stick, you know the deal, Keith, you know. And it got to my lips and I grabbed a hold of it and I forced it down my throat and into my gut, and it burnt the entire time. It didn't, like, oh, this is wonderful, tickles me all the way through. It didn't do that at all. It was like swallowing nails dipped in kerosene. And but once it hit my gut and it started going through the rest of my body, and it wasn't the same effect that it went through the rest of my body. It started making things turn on fire and glow and warm up and just tingle, like, the, I don't know, it just went straight to my head, down to my toes. And the only thing I ever had close to that was watching an old black and white show where the two couples fell in love, where their eyes connected and they portrayed that feeling that they fell in love at that magical moment. That's exactly, that's the only idea that I had about love. Like, I love what it did to me. So much that I drank as much as I could and as long as I could that night. Totally forgot about the curfew. Never once thought about it. But I sure as heck thought about taking off my clothes and jumping in the water naked at 13 years old and looking as manly as you can. And around those 18, 19 year olds, and I'd swim around, jump through the fire, run back into the water, kiss a girl. She slapped me and giggled and swam away. And I was like, man, I'm having the time of my life. I don't know how it is for anybody else. And that's kind of how it was the rest of my drinking. I don't know how it was for anybody else, but I was having the time of my life. Until it was time, it was gone. It was all done. Not once did I think, it's getting a little late, I need to back off, I need to go home. No, it was all done. There was no more liquor to be drank that night, and everybody had left. And it was just me, and I grabbed my clothes, and I stumbled all the way back to the camper, and my dad ripped the door right off the hinge. You know, he looked right at me, and he said, you're drunk, aren't you? I'm like, oh, and I don't come from a drinking family. Not one of my family drank, ever. I got a great grandmother that celebrated 104 years of sobriety when she passed away. I remember being a smart aleck little newcomer at 10 years. I got a 10-year coin 1 year, right? And I told her about it. And I'm like, look at that, Grandma. She goes, what is this? She's from Poland. She goes, what is this you got? I'm like, this is for 10 years of not drinking. That's so nice. What do you get for 97? I'm like, 97 what? Just 97 of no drinking. I'm like, You drink. I know you drink. She goes, never. I said, we're Maronites. And I know that's in our creed. She goes, not the good ones. That's all she ever had to say. Not the good ones. You know, other people do, but not the good ones. 104 years, never drinking. None of her kids ever drank. My parents never drank. They would warn me about people like you. Like I said, we lived in Detroit, Hamtramck, Pole Town. It's a Polish community, and you know, they warned us about people, and the Germans, the Irish, and the Italians. And I didn't think nothing of it. I thought they were just, they never went down there and hung out with them. They were just talking ignorance. Because if they knew what that happened at that party, at that fire, they would have been promoting drinking. They would have been making me drink. It was so wonderful. I didn't drink every single day. I did not drink for, I drank 4 years as much as I could, and as long as I could, and as often as I could. I never once in 4 years said, not tonight. I got a soccer practice, not tonight. It was always absolutely, and I'll figure out what to do about that later on, if I were asked. That's how my drinking went. I was a disappointment to everybody that I came in contact with and didn't really realize it at that time. They were already disappointed. I would still show up and make it even worse for them. You know, I'd be drunk when I'd show up, and they were always uncomfortable around me, and I don't understand why, you know. And I would just hang out with them no matter what. Just make it worse, you know. I know you're disappointed. I know you're disgusted with my behavior and the fact that I show up drunk all the time, but I'm going to stay here anyways. You know, my my first year in high school was pretty odd and significant. I kind of lived my life at the time like, if I didn't have the information, I would make it up. And it's usually made up by MTV, WWF, and some other weird concept that I would come up with on my own, with all my experience that I had at 14 years old. And so when I walked into high school, I was convinced that I needed to make a name for myself. You know, you either had to be an honor grad, an honor roll student, or you had to be a tough guy. And I know who I am. I know my scores in school and my grades. I haven't missed looking at my report card for the last umpteen years. I know I'm probably not going to be that guy, you know? Just know it. I'm going to be blue collar worker, and that's okay. Be good at it, you know? And so I'm like, well, that's going to take too long and too hard, and I'm not into it. And so I got to find somebody in school, and so I did. Walked down the middle of the hallway, and some kid walked this way, and I walked that way. He wasn't moving, I wasn't moving. I'm like, oh my God, here it goes. And he bumped into me, and he spun me around to say something, and I just clocked him real quick in the mouth, and he went down. I was like, this is amazing. This is amazing. Just like TV. He won one shot, and he's done. You know, WWF style or whatever. And but I didn't count on him. You know, I didn't think it all the way through. He popped right back up. I was like, great, now what do I got? I got nothing. You know, I've never done this before. I watch it on TV. I think about it all the time when I'm drinking or not drinking. I don't know how to do this. You know, he started calling me a bunch of names. Like I said, I grew up with a very good Maronite Catholic family that did not drink. We didn't talk about people's parents like that, but he sure did. And I had nothing to say. I had nothing to say about it. And I'm like, all right, I'll meet you after school. I think I saw that in an after school ABC special. And we'll meet in the parking lot in the cul-de-sac. And the first day of school, freshman versus the senior. He was a senior. I didn't know that. I didn't know anybody. And I'm the freshman, new guy. First day, first fight, the entire high school shows up. And that's a lot of people, right? But back it up a second. You know, I'm having to wait 6 hours to do something that I've never done in my entire life. You know, fear started creeping in there. How couldn't it, you know? I know the book says fear is the evil corroding thread, the fabric of our existence. This was telling me that it's not a good idea, but I wasn't listening. That's what this fear was telling me. This is not a good idea. Probably shouldn't do this. Probably should apologize. Probably should do something else. get them, you know, cake and, you know, whatever. But not at all, man. That's not what I did. My best friend Randy pulls out something out of his pocket. I don't know what it was, but I took it. He said, try these keys. These will help. I'm like, absolutely. I don't even know what it is. Just drank a Little King's beer with it. And I'm so glad it wasn't laxatives. You know, I never even asked what it was or what it would do. I was just like, sure, let's do it. And it wasn't laxatives. It was, I don't even know what it was. He never told me. I never asked. But I know it was out. All I knew was I was pretty excited to get there. All of a sudden, I was excited. I was already done with it in my head and in my body. I was already done. It's already happened, and I'm ready to go home. But they show up to the big cul-de-sac, and there's hundreds of people there. And I'm like, I charge right through there, and I jump into the middle of it. And he's standing there, and he doesn't have a shirt. He's wanting to say something, and I just kick him. And I just kick him, and I keep kicking him. And I kicked him unconscious. And I kicked him for another 5-6 minutes, and then I picked him up and I slammed him on a brick. And then I took that brick and I hit more and more and more. I couldn't stop hitting him. I didn't want to stop hitting him. And nothing like that had ever existed in my entire life, folks. I was not like that. I was not raised to do that to any human being. And all I wanted to do was, I wanted to murder him, and I don't even know where that came from. I had no significant emotional events going on in my life. I wasn't raised with, you know, horrific things in my life. I just unleashed, and people were screaming and people were crying, trying to grab me, and I went after it. And it wasn't until the cops came and my cousin grabs me and throws me in the car, and I'm covered in mess, and my eyes are just gone, and my soul is gone, and he's like, Jesus, what in God's name is wrong with you? And I'm like, just take me to my girlfriend's house. Just take me to my girlfriend. And so he drives me to my girlfriend's house, which is like 10 blocks away in the same town. And I get out. And apparently she already heard over the phone, the dialing phones you used back then. She answers the door. She's like, you're disgusting. I never want to see you again. I'm like, are you serious? What is wrong with you? And I had some choice words in the back of my head. I didn't say them out loud ever. You know, I just looked at him like, you're disgusting me. One bite and you leave, that's it? I'm done with you. I walked 2 blocks over to my best friend Randy, who gave me that stuff out of his pocket. And he was in detention already. First day of school, he's in detention. And I'm waiting. And I don't even know what. It's just my luck, right? That's what I thought, just my luck. It's the kind of people I hang out with. It's the kind of people I attract. And I go into the basement and I start drinking the beer that's been sitting next to the furnace for the last 18, 19 years. I'm sure it's warm as God off. It's probably spoiled, but it works. It still works. And so I'm drinking these Rainier beer. I knew it then because his dad used to go to Washington and he'd bring this God awful beer back and we'd steal it all the time. And I'm drinking it. And I know Randy's mom and dad just split. And I hear his mom rustling around upstairs. And so I go up. I don't want to freak her out. And she comes up to me. She goes, oh, Keith, it's good to see you. Went to hug me, and I kissed her right on the lips. In 5 seconds, we had formed a relationship. Formed a deep and meaningful relationship as far as I was concerned, you know. And that was where my headspace was at the time. And she reared back and smacked me and said, what are you doing? And get out of here. And that's like one day of my drinking, you know. So, I mean, in 39 years, I've had schmucks come up to me and say, maybe you didn't drink long enough. I'm like, really, you want to go drink tonight? Want to find out? See how that goes for you? I know how it's going to go for me, but it's I'm worried about you. Yeah. Because we're the kind of alcoholics that I've learned in all these years. We're the kind of alcoholics that go out with hard drinkers, and we drive their car home because they pass out at the bar. And we lump them on their lawn in front of their wives or our moms or our dads, and we slump them, we put our foot on their chest, and we look down at them, and we look at our parents, our wives, or whoever, and say, you want me to drink like this? Are you serious? I drink just fine. Leave me alone. You know, my propensity for drinking alcohol is insane, as I'm sure as yours is, because I couldn't stop, and you couldn't stop, no matter how much I wanted to. no matter how much you threw at me, how much you tried to teach me. I know Steve's old enough and other people are probably old enough to know Scared Straight program came out in about 85, 84, 86. I went to it in 86, came to my high school, and the guy, there was a celebrity, a movie star, he played in Stand and Deliverance. It was a Hispanic fella, and he's all nose broke over, his pit of skin, and I think his name Amos or Ace, I can't remember off the top of my head, but he was the lead speaker, and he was talking like a tough guy, you know, and all these prison guards and all these prisoners and all these psychiatrists and you people come there with your Bridging the Gap deal and talk about your experience, strength, and hope to people that don't really care and want to hear about it. And I'm listening to it, I'm just like, what a bunch of losers, man. To get caught, to have to go to prison. And I was listening to them talking about being somebody's girlfriend in Jackson prison or Ionia prison. You know, I'm like, not this guy. Not this guy, you know, and my best friend Randy sitting right next to me, he's drunker than Cooter Brown. Drunk as, I mean, we're both drunk as Cooter Brown, but he couldn't shut his mouth. And they grabbed him and put him up on stage, and it was just like, Jake brought him up to Sears School when they use him as an example. And he starts smacking, you know, just screaming in his face and pushing him down and yelling at him and blah, blah. And I'm cracking up. Because I'm about 18 Little Kings into it, and I'm just like, what the heck is this? You know, but I did learn. I learned if I, not to drink as much as those guys did and get put into places like those guys did, and I thought that that was enough. That just behave myself, just act accordingly, you know, drink responsibly. And as soon as that assembly was over, I didn't think nothing about that ever again in my life. Not until I came to AA. That was gone. Every promise, every solemn oath, every plea, every second, third, fourth, fifth chance begging for it, out my head, the moment you left, the moment I left, or the moment it came out of my mouth. It didn't mean that I didn't mean it. It didn't. I meant every word of it. If you strap me to the lie detector, and I'm sure you would have too, I would have passed. I wasn't going to drink. My mom, my brother, my sister, my aunts, my uncles, they all meant more to me than liquor meant to me. Guaranteed. Even today, everybody meant, but it wasn't up to me whether I was drinking anymore. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that until I met you folks. And I read your book, and I read your Dr. Silkworth's opinion, and finding out that, yeah, it's not my fault that I'm drinking, but I'm responsible for fixing it. And Alcoholics Anonymous has helped me fix that. But I am not responsible. It was not my fault while I was drinking in the end of my drinking. I couldn't stop, no matter how much the need, wish, or the desire to do so. No matter how many pleas, no matter how many prayers of, you know, and candles lit and, you know, I just couldn't do it, no matter how much I wanted to. It's like being born. My sponsor and I talk about this all the time. You know, until the day I was born, I never inhaled a breath of air in my entire life. My entire, 38, 39 months of gestation, you know, being in my mom's womb, I've never inhaled ever. But once I did, I couldn't stop. And once I did, I would do anything to get more of it and to keep it coming. If you would have blocked my airway, I would have hurt you, not intentionally, but in a panic to get some more of it. I was hooked on air. I was hooked on alcohol. I couldn't, even though it wasn't working anymore, I couldn't stop. I got busted in 86. Right, I got busted in 87. So January 1st of 1987 was the first day I stopped drinking deliberately. And, you know, I've had other periods of brief recovery, not because I wanted to, just I didn't have enough money, it wasn't available, I wasn't in a position. Nobody was gonna. No, I didn't know anybody to steal it from. And, but the night before was the setup of it. I had become so paranoid and so delusional through my drinking that I was dating a gal and living in her mom and dad's basement, and I thought she was cheating on me. I don't know why. I mean, I do know, because I was cheating on her. And I always invite, you know, I always looked at myself and judged my intentions, not my actions. That's all I ever saw was my intentions. Not once did I ever look at actions. And so I always figured I was too drunk to catch her. Again, I don't know where it came from. But living like that and the way I lived, those things pop up, right? And I figured I was just too drunk to catch her. So I would just drink one beer. One beer. I would just nurse it as long as I could until I would catch her that night. It seemed like a formidable plan, seemed foolproof. The fool was making it, you know, but I was like gonna sit there miserably on a couch, New Year's Eve, you know, celebration, mistletoes everywhere, her family's everywhere. But she was gonna cheat on me in front of me and her whole family. It was a good idea. And it's getting close to midnight. I'm getting antsy. I've been holding that bottle of Miller Genuine Draft, and I only know it because if you hold a bottle, or you're an alcoholic like I am, and you hold a bottle for more than an hour, you know exactly where it's. That's in you for life. You remember that for life. And I just remember just gripping it. It was piss warm by the time it was halfway done, and nobody's there to kiss her. Nobody's there to make do whatever they were gonna do. And finally a guy neighbor came in, opens the door, there's mistletoe. My girlfriend comes over and to give him a hug, and he kissed her on the cheek. I'm like, you know what, that's good enough for me. And I jumped up and I punched him in the mouth, and he went down, just like the first guy. And I had victory, I was like, oh my God, now I can drink. Now everybody else knows it, they can feel fine to party, and they all looked at me in a different, they weren't having the same experience as I was. I was elated, getting ready to run around the room like Rocky. And they were like, get out of our house. We never want to see you again. You're not welcomed here. And it was the blizzard of 86, 1986 in Michigan. And it's always a blizzard that we get sober in, or a hurricane, or a tropical depression, or, you know, whatever. The moon fell out of the sky and crushed your car. I mean, it's always something like that for us. And that was mine. You know, I walked out without a jacket, and it was snowing sideways, and you couldn't see. And I was like, oh my God. And I panicked. And I'm walking down, and I'm feeling the weight of everything. I have nowhere to go. I have no family. I have no friends. Can't get out of this winter. I just screwed up the last good thing that I had, or at least I thought I had. I couldn't stop drinking, and I didn't have no liquor, and no liquor to get. And I felt it, and I started crying out in the middle of the snowbank. And I'm like, oh my God, if you just help me. If you just help me, I will do whatever it is that you want me to. And I prayed like my life depended on it. And I know what you're thinking, that all of a sudden all the little street lights came on in a row, just like the miracle on 34th Street, or it's a white Christmas or whatever, and it stopped snowing all the way down the street. And there was the church of, you know, the Holy Sepulchre at the end of the church, and God and my family just, well, that's not what happened. It started snowing faster and harder, and I was panicking. I'm like, I'll just break into my mom's house. She's close. And I snuck into her basement, and I detoxed for the next 3 days. And on the fourth day, she came downstairs and found me. And there was nothing but candy wrappers everywhere. I didn't know that was a thing. Like, I get sober, and they got a bunch of candy at every table I went to in AA. But I'm crushing candy. I'm crushing cookies. I'm crushing anything sweet. I'm, like, force-feeding diabetes into my life as fast as I could. She comes down there and screams. She goes, I thought I told you. I'm like, I'm sober. I've been sober for 4 days. And I'm not going to drink. I don't want to drink. And she goes, well, you should talk to your friend Randy. He went to treatment. And I'm like, My best friend Randy went to treatment. That's right. And so he comes over and he starts talking to me about AA, and I'm like, shut up. I don't want to hear about that. I remember what they did to you at Scared Straight. Shut up. You don't know nothing. He's like, all right. Well, he goes upstairs and talks to my mom. My mom had already gone to Al-Anon at that time. And a couple days later, my uncle comes over. And he drove 200 some odd miles from Pennsylvania to have a talk with me. He was a sober member of AA for like 18 years. And he got sober in some federal prison, found AA, found God, and wanted to come and deliver the message to me. And I loved it. I loved exactly what he said to me. I believed. He never told me once about my drinking. He only talked about his drinking. And I was getting ready to say yes, and his wife, who was a treatment counselor, said, you need treatment. I'm like, absolutely, you're right. Martin Sheen's kid went to treatment on one of the movies I saw. And once he graduated, everybody gave him gifts and gave him a new car, and he got a new girlfriend, and everybody loved him. That's what I want. I don't know nothing about sobriety. I got 4 days. I already know how to do it. So I conned him into sending me to treatment, and they did. I went to treatment, and guess what they did? They brought me to AA meetings anyways. It was just the strangest thing. You know, I was 17. I was the youngest kid in there. They put me on the women's ward instead of the men's. Like, that's a good idea, you know. And because those women are catty and handsy. They always want you to change a light bulb or look at their air filter or whatever, you know. You know what I mean? Without getting into that. But they would take me to Ann Arbor. That was the first meetings I would go to in Ann Arbor, Washtenaw Alano Club. It was always filled with the Detroit Tigers. I'll get to that in a second. And Sammy Davis Jr. hung out there all the time. Because I remember when I went to my first meeting there, they were all in their uniforms. And there was Sammy Davis Jr. with his bodyguard in a zoot suit and a fedora hat and a chain and glasses, and all knuckles were covered in gold, and so was his bodyguard standing behind him. And I remember going to my counselor, asked me what I thought about AA. I'm like, it's awesome. I mean, the Tigers are a little sensitive. I understand why they suck. They're always crying and talking about problems at the meeting. I said, but you know, whatever. At least they're the Tigers, and I get to hang out with the Detroit Tigers. And I said, the cool part is I saw Sammy Davis Jr. and his bodyguard, and that was pretty cool. I don't know if Sammy Davis Jr. was dead yet or alive. I have no idea. But my counselor says, tell me about Sammy Davis Jr. I told him about him. I told him about his bodyguard, and he says, you're about the most ignorant kid I've ever met in this treatment facility. He goes, that was Luther. He was court-ordered to Alcoholics Anonymous, and his parole officer stands there and makes sure, because I guess they didn't have anklets at that time, so their parole officer used to stand behind them and make them go to AA and stand on their chest. And it was a pretty popular outfit back in the 80s, you know, the Prince and the Revolution and Time and, you know, the coats. I'm like, and the Tigers, they're doing pretty good this year, and everybody's wearing a jersey, stupid. He says, so why don't you just shut your mouth? I was so not about that. That guy's name was Steve also. I was like, I don't like this guy. If I ever meet people like that in AA, I will stay away from them. You know, but Steve was the only member of Alcoholics Anonymous that was a member, that was a staff member at that treatment center. He goes, how about just do AA and see what happens, stupid? Does that sound good to you? He goes, we don't need your interpretation of anything. We just need you to try to do AA and see what happens in your life. I'm like, I'll remember that, Steve. I hope you die. Thinking to myself, because I was gutless and I couldn't say these things out loud. I was polite. I was passive aggressive and I was polite. I would always think these things at you. I would never say these things to you. I ended up leaving treatment center. I didn't know anything about AA. I just knew where not to go. And yet I found it everywhere I went. I found people like that everywhere. My first meeting in my hometown was called the Dignitary Sympathy Group. It's out of, they got three of them up there. I heard they got one down here somewhere. I'm not promoting it. I'm just saying that that's where I went. It's a all men's meeting, 2-hour, non-smoking, and it's a sponsor or invite-only meeting, and the meeting's been around since 1939, something like that. And they're horrible people there. I mean, literally, they're just awful human beings. Like, you should get the message when you look at their name. It's called the Dignitary Sympathy Group. You don't get none. If you're in AA and you're in trouble, it better be your fault. That's kind of like their mantra. I'm like all the time? Like, it should be my fault always? They're like, always, it better be your fault. I'm like, why? They're like, because you can't do nothing about nobody else, can you? I don't know, you could threaten them. They're going to do it to you anyways. Either to you or around you or behind you, but they're going to do it. It better be your fault. They were trying to teach me accountability. I didn't know anything about that. So they give you how it works, and when their sponsor gives you how it works to read, that means you're the first one to share. And that means you're on the chopping block for all the old-timers there to tell you about you and to tell you what you know their experience with what you do. And so I start reading, and the group leader's like, "So Mike, your sponsor tells us you're all screwed up. What's going on?" I'm like, and I look at Mike, I'm like, "You're a rat. What is wrong with you, dude? You're a rat, son of a gun." And so I didn't know what to say, so I didn't know what I tell Mike, because it was probably lies, or what I thought he wanted to hear, or I made stuff up. And so I do what I do, I make things up. Start complaining about my job, which I don't have. I complain about a girlfriend that I used to have, but I don't have anymore. I'm complaining about my mom and school and everything else that I'm not doing or a part of. And this guy, Ted, in the back says, "Hold on a second. You got a girlfriend?" I'm like, that's all he got out of that rant. I said, "Yeah, why?" He goes, as if it's any of your business. He goes, "Well, this is what I would think. That, like, maybe you should just kill yourself and leave other people alone. Like, that's all you do is kill people. That's all you got to offer people, is to take and murder whatever they got going on in their lives. You annihilate and engulf everything that you touch. And anybody that you touch is engulfed by you. You just suck it dry and leave the remnants and move on. That's all you do. Or am I lying?" I'm like, I had nothing to say, except I could shoot him a look, like, you know, the look we give. And he goes, "You better knock that look off your face." I'm like, he says this out loud. Like, who says that in an AA meeting? You know, he says, "You better knock that look off your face or I'll come over there and knock it off you. And if you don't think I can, these guys that I sponsor every Tuesday night to come to this meeting from Jackson Prison will gladly meet you in the parking lot after the meeting and knock that look off your face. When I'm trying to help you and keep you and help you save your own life, and you're going to shoot me a look like that?" I was like, I could sucker punch at least two of the guys, is what I'm thinking. I'm not getting the message. I could sucker punch. I know I could knock that old man out. And the other two guys right next to him, they won't suspect it. I'd probably kick one, punch the other. Going through the whole thing, right? So after the meeting, he comes over to me. He says, "I'm glad you stuck around." I'm like, "Really? I had to. My sponsor drove me here. It's 2 hours from my house. Or Uber doesn't exist. I'm 17 years old. I don't have a job. I don't have a credit card. I don't got money. I work one day a week at probably some fast food joint, I think. Or I get picked up roughing or something. He's my ride, you know. I'm stuck." He goes, "I care enough about you to tell you the truth." He goes, "I'm not your friend. I will never be your friend. I would like to one day." He goes, "But you're 17 years old and I'm an old man. I'm not here to be your friend. I'm here to help you save your life. And if we become friends later on in life, so be it. But I would rather you be alive and get this thing, and then we'll see what happens. He said, plus, if you can't keep a plant alive that only takes water and sunlight for a year, how in God's name are you going to take care of a relationship that takes way more than that? I had nothing. So I ended up going through the steps. Lickety split, right? I've heard this all my sobriety. Like, how do you go through the steps so quickly? I don't know. I'll ask Dr. Bob how he went through the steps so quickly. Read his nightmare. See how fast he went through it. It wasn't about me understanding anything. It's not about me defending myself to nobody. It simply is I needed to do these things immediately. I needed what you talk about on We Agnostics. I suffer from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. I can go to as many of these things as I want to. I can get as many sponsors. I can get as many duty positions in AA as I want to. I can get on the hierarchy or the board of whatever, of running AA right into the ground, of GSO and GSRs and DCMs and committee members, all I want. But if I don't have a spiritual experience, I will not be able to match that and conquer alcoholism, and it will run my life again. And I will not be able to stay sober. I will not be able to not act like an alcoholic who is in desperate need of ease and comfort everywhere I go all the time. And if I don't get it, I will find it somehow, some way. That's why I need a spiritual experience. That solves that. Liquor didn't solve it anymore. Liquor just got me drunk. But the freedom that I desperately needed was founded by having a spiritual experience. And if that's what I need to stay sober, and I'm not getting that, then what keeps me sober? Nothing. What knowledge? How much I know about this? How many friends I make in AA? And if I'm the popular guy or the unpopular guy or the... Is that what it does? I need a spiritual experience. That's all I need. I need a spiritual experience. And it's funny because that's what your entire book is about. Is about enabling a guy like me to find a guy, a power greater than myself. That's it, man. And see what happens. I went through the steps. They asked me, are you powerless? I'm like, yes. I ain't got no choice. I got no choice. I'm a little reprieved right now. I don't know why, but I am for a second at the time I met my sponsor. But I know I will. It's only a matter of time. Nice people go back out and drink all the time. I'm not a nice guy. I will take a drink. Kindest people in the world I've ever met in my entire life. They fall off. They drink. What makes me think that me being a turd that I was and that I can be is anything better? It's not about me being nice. It's not about me being good. If a mere code of moral, better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcohol, I would have, or these nuns and these priests that I got sober with up in Detroit would have never drank to begin with because they help people out, whereas I don't. They pray more than I've ever prayed in my entire life, probably in one weekend, and yet they drank still, and they ended up in our rooms. It's not about me getting a better moral philosophy or a better philosophy of life. It's about me having a spiritual experience. Second step, came to believe. You betcha. I tried everything, and I didn't find it. I tried working out for her. I tried girlfriends for her, cars, motorcycles, jobs, scary jobs, cool jobs, dumb jobs, nasty jobs, different locations, north, south, east, west, Pacific, Afghanistan, Iraq, everywhere. Nothing worked. Page 31 says it. These are the methods that I've tried. These are the methods that failed. But I never tried God. And I don't have to explain God. I don't have to invent a deity in these rooms. I really don't. God has always been there in my life. I just need to get rid of the obstacles that have been blocking it from happening. And it will show itself. And it does. And it continues to show itself constantly to me. I don't need nobody else. I don't need to consider another person's conception. My own, as inadequate as it might be, or as adequate, is sufficient. I made a decision. A contract with God in the third step. If you do these things for me, God, I will do these things for you. If you do this for me, I will do this for you. I can quote a book, but this is what I experience in my life is I do these things, he'll do these things. God always does these things, and I always welch, or I always skimp. You know, it's kind of like a deal between you and the mortgage company, right? If you give me this $800,000 loan for this house that I don't deserve, I will gladly pay you monthly. And what happens is that it goes well for about 5 years. 5 years, something happens. Something always happens. I need to fix this. I didn't save up for that. This happens, that happens, right? And so I miss a payment or two or three. They don't come and take the house immediately. I got grace. I have grace. I'm still living in the house. And they're still giving me an opportunity. They're still letting me go on. But eventually they have to take the house. And eventually, if I don't work in God's grace, grace will fade. Alcoholism will take over in my life and I will drink again. That's how it works in my life. Fourth step, I had a list of people that were stupid and dumb and that owed me an amends. I know you read it a little bit differently, but that's what it looks like to me, is that they're stupid, dumb, and they owe me an amends, right? And I make columns, four of them, or three. And that's as far as I ever get in my life, is the person that wronged me, the thing that they did to me, and how it affected my life. That's as far as I got. You know how I know? The book said it. My experience conveys it. Is that that's as far as most of us ever get to conclude they were wrong. I don't need to go any further. And my sponsor tells me, goes, perhaps you're right, Keith. 100% they're that way. They are the jerks that you think they are. They did all those things to you. 100%. How much freedom have you experienced? I was like, you dirty rat, man. None. None. Being so right, I've experienced no freedom. Because let's put ourselves on the hook. If they were to write inventory tonight, every single one of those names on that list, what would they say about you? And what did you affect in their lives? Like, that is so horrible to do to somebody. It's like trickery. But the magic in it is when I'm on the hook, they get off the hook. Nobody's ever entered my life without me conveying or allowing it to happen to begin with, I found out. And when I find that I set the ball rolling first, I can't help but take them off the hook. And instead of my prayers looking like something like, forgive us of our trespasses, but the heck with that guy, you know, it starts looking like, forgive us of our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass. Because I've done the same things that they have, and yet I want forgiveness. Man, give it and see if it doesn't come. Give the forgiveness and see if forgiveness doesn't come. Sixth step, I asked God to remove, you know, I became willing quickly, right? Quickly, everybody always complains it's only one paragraph, the sixth and the seventh step. Like, how long do you need? Like, what do you want? Read the 12 and 12, it says the exact same thing. It stretches it out to four pages. It says the same thing as the sixth and the seventh. Let God know that I'm ready and ask God when I am ready. There's nothing that I get to do. I can't do anything about my defects, but God can. All I can do is stay busy doing what I believe he would want me, and God's work starts to happen. I owed a lot of people amends. And it wasn't about when I'm ready to make them. It was about when they were available and fixing their lives and sitting down with them for a long talk. That's what it says. It doesn't say I show up with a check or an apology. It says I'm prepared for a long talk with these people and to set matters straight. That sounds a lot different than just making amends. Hey, Steve, I stole something and here's some. No, it's Steve. When you got a moment, I'd like to talk to you. Sit down and talk to you. Tell you what's going on. And not making an apology or excuses for what I did, but just making arrangements to fix it the best that I can. And in the process of making amends, I'm to continue to practice these principles by taking a 10 step daily. I don't always, like I said, sometimes I'm late on my mortgage. But I pay my mortgage. But I pay my mortgage. Constantly. You know how you make it, you know, 39 years, we were talking about this before the meeting. I wasn't planning on staying here 39 years. Are you kidding me? Like, nobody does that. You know, somebody asked me, well, your 40th is coming up. What are you going to do? I'm like, quit. Really? You're just going to quit? Not at all. I'm probably going to do the same thing that I do today as I did way back then, is I'm going to wake up in the morning and I'm going to say, thank you, God, for these beautiful things that are in my life today. The children that you blessed me that I don't deserve. The wife that I take for granted all the time, who I think I do way more than she does in this relationship. I'm under no delusions that that's true at all. But I think these, and I thank God, and I ask him, show me what I can do for people today. Help me to help your children, since you've helped me out so much. Way more than that kid that showed up here looking at 8 years in prison, in Jackson prison. And I didn't serve one day. I got to sign up and join the military and retire from the military. I got to be a GS for a long time, and I got to be a contractor for a long time. I've got to raise a 30-year-old, a 25-year-old, a 15, 8, and a 7-year-old. I'm catching up to you guys that bragged about having wives, more than one wives. I'm on number 3. But I've been married and faithful. All 3 of them. All 3 of them for 30 years. I've been married for 30 years, not to the same person. My wife and I just celebrated 11 years the other day, and I still can't believe it. You know, life is not over. Life is by far not over. It still throws me something every day, every week, every month, something comes up. You know, I'm a grandfather today to my oldest son who gave me a granddaughter. I never thought that. I didn't think I was going to live to 21 years of age. And I was okay with that. I was okay with that. Today, I try to do whatever I can to stay around for them as long as I can, and as long as they'll have me. So, Steve, Jake, Bob, I appreciate you guys having me, Mike, and having me up here. And I'm blessed, man. Appreciate it.
Yep. Looks like some drunks out there didn't miss something pretty good tonight. Keith, thank you for coming out tonight. Sorry our turnout wasn't as great as it was, but I know I got a lot out of it. It's probably the second time I've heard you speak. Not sharing the meetings and not going to meetings, but actually getting up and telling your story. The way I remember it last time, this was fundamentally different. I don't know that the sobriety piece was any different, but the story was freaking fantastic, so glad I was here. Appreciate that.